First matter on calendar this morning is Burton versus State of Nevada. If parties make sure they announce who they are for the record, also if you wish to reserve any time.
Yes, Your Honor.
Please let us know.
I'd ask to reserve 5 minutes. Your Honor, Christopher Orem on behalf of Mr. Burton. Mr. Burton's murder conviction should be overturned for multiple reasons. In this particular case, there was an abundance of inadmissible testimonial proffered information that was introduced. Specifically, during opening argument, the state argued that there had been a tip that had been received, which identified Thayer Burton as the murderer. The very next day, defense counsel moved for a mistrial based upon the argument that that was inadmissible. Then, during the testimony of the lead detective on direct examination, again, the state asked Detective Laura Anderson, did she receive a tip that identified Thayer Burton as the murderer? Now, who becomes the accuser? The tipster becomes the accuser. Is this just something that leads Detective Anderson in a particular way? No, of course not. Really, what it does is it says Thayer Burton's the murderer.
Isn't there a divergent case law on that issue depending on how it's done?
I did not see any case law that would support inadmissible testimonial hearsay, which goes to the ultimate conclusion.
Well, that was the point in terms of what specifically was said by the detective as to this alleged tip.
The specific statement is that a tip was received. Now, in opening argument, and during Detective Laura Anderson's testimony, the question was asked, did you receive information that led you to investigate Thayer Burton as a possible suspect? Yes. And during the state's opening argument, they say eventually the police received a tip. The tip identified Thayer Burton as the murderer. I don't think anything could be more clear than that. How does Thayer Burton confront that? There is absolutely no way to confront that type of allegation. And to me, that seems obviously a violation of the Confrontation Clause, and it's testimonial because it came through the police. I don't think there could be an argument that this was not a blatant violation of the Crawford standard, and specifically because it's testimonial. The state argues it should be a plain error standard because there wasn't a contemporaneous objection during opening argument. The difficulty with that is it's compounded from opening argument, then there's a mistrial request, and after that, then you have, again, the questioning of the lead detective in the same manner. Now, what's even more concern is during Detective Laura Anderson's testimony, she begins to summarize the entire case for approximately 10 pages from Bates Stamp 1630 to Bates Stamp 1640. In that time period, what she summarizes is filled with own hearsay. She talks about an interview with Lucius Reblis, who is a worker at the Ashley Furniture Store. She never testified. She concludes that that is the unindicted co-conspirator who had the inside knowledge and must have given it to Thayer Burton. She testified that that particular individual was uncooperative, wouldn't turn over cell phone records. Again, that was all testimonial hearsay. The detective then states that she...
Well, isn't that just based upon her personal knowledge and her conduct of the investigation?
Well, how
it's an observation as opposed to some kind of testimonial hearsay.
How would one conclude that Ms. Revelis is a unindicted co-conspirator without relying upon hearsay? It wasn't like an observation that I walked over to her and she walked away. That would not be. But here, what you're concluding is that she, or what she concluded, the detective, was that she is an unindicted co-conspirator. And so to me, I don't see how it could be an observation. In order to determine whether this person over here is an unindicted co-conspirator, I have to rely upon a whole bunch of information. Where does that information come from? It comes from interviewing all of the people at Ashley Furniture, which she also testified to, that she interviewed all these different people, none of which testified. In addition, she said that she eliminated 15 to 20 suspects, and she actually named some of them. She named one as Danelli Coronado, James Ray Taylor. And what is of concern there is that she is actually saying that, look, I looked at everybody, and I'm able to eliminate these particular people. You combine that with the fact that I have a tip that identifies Thayer Burton as the killer. Combine that with the fact that he must have relied upon the information given by the unindicted co-conspirator. None of those people testified. So that seems like a gross violation of Crawford. Additionally, well, I think...
Mr. Yes, perhaps you could comment on this. part of the detective's testimony was offered in this manner to respond to the suggestion that the investigation was inadequate or incomplete or insufficient, and therefore it was necessary for this testimony to be offered.
I understand that that is the state's argument, and I understand that...
Well, I just wanted to hear what your view was of that argument. Well,
to me,
it isn't sound.
To me, Laura Anderson did not need to spend 10 pages summarizing the entire investigation, relying heavily on testimonial hearsay. Here is what can happen easily if somebody says it's not a thorough investigation. Detective, did you see CSA's crime scene analyst dust for fingerprints? Yes, then put on the fingerprint analyst. Do the same with DNA. Show that it was a thorough investigation. Don't just have a detective say, I eliminated 15 or 20 suspects without calling any of the suspects. I got a tip that identifies him as the murderer, the ultimate question. I know who the inside person is. Here's who it is. You do all of that. That is not just rebutting an allegation that this was not a thorough investigation. Furthermore, isn't every defense attorney in a criminal case going to say it wasn't a thorough investigation? Does that then somehow lead to an exception to the Crawford analysis by the United States Supreme Court that Crawford applies to the state courts? However, if there's an allegation by defense counsel that there was an inadequate investigation, then those rules go out the door and you can just use as much testimonial hearsay as you want. You know, in this case, in Reyes versus the United States, the Second Circuit described how it is improper for a detective to sort of summarize the investigation, which is exactly what happened here. They describe it as essentially an exciting story. And if you read the 10 pages from 1630 to 1640, it is an exciting story. She eliminated suspects, she got a tip. But if you look at Reyes, they give us some indication of what the standard should be. Was the information uncontested? Well, I would argue, of course, it was contested. There was nobody who even testified to these matters. And that's another factor they ask us to look at. Were the declarants available for cross-examination? No, they didn't call any of these witnesses. Would the statements by the detective be credited by the jury? In this case, I would imagine that the jury probably looked at Detective Anderson and thought, yes, this is a credible witness. She knows what she's doing. She's telling us the truth. She's eliminated everyone. Thayer Burton is guilty. And was there an curative instruction given? In this case, absolutely not. So when you take all of those together, you recognize there was just so many different violations all contained within what Detective Anderson did. Combine that with another error. During closing argument, the state argues, Mr. Burton testified in his own defense, said, I'm not guilty. I did not commit this crime. The prosecutor then states to the jury, how do you prove something you didn't do? Maybe you come up with a story a year and a half after a murder and come up with a story that conveniently fits all the pieces of the puzzle or explains away every piece of incriminating evidence. Maybe that's what you do. Now, when I researched the matter on Murray in 1989, this court addressed a very similar fact pattern. In Murray, the prosecutor said in closing argument, it's quite interesting, as you watch the course of the evidence develop, that Mr. Murray was able to sit here and listen to everyone testify. He had all the records of all the witness statements. The prosecutor further stated, of course, Mr. Murray, you see, didn't tell his story until 5 months after contemplating listening to all the witnesses. And this court reversed and used the following standard, saying that the prosecutor's comments violated the defendant's right against self-incrimination. The comment was designed to diminish the defendant's credibility, which is exactly what happened here. It was designed to say, you can't believe Thayer Burton. Look at what he did. He watched all of the testimony. He didn't give a statement. He didn't say anything, and then he makes it all fit neatly after everyone's testified. Three, the defendant's credibility was a vital issue in the case. Here, of course, it's a vital issue in the case. The man got up, testified in his own behalf, and said, I'm innocent of murder. Fourth, the comment was prosecutorial misconduct, which resulted in reversal. And this court further explained, the comment suggested that the only reason the defendant seemed at all credible was because the defendant could remain silent, listen to the testimony of other witnesses, then Murray could fabricate a story consistent with the story, with the testimony that he had already heard. Now, when I see that, I see this as an identical situation. And so I believe that we have met all of the standards enunciated by this court in Murray, and there is a clear Fifth Amendment violation. I realize that I only have 5 minutes remaining, and so I'd like to keep that for rebuttal unless there are any questions about some of the other issues that I had raised.
Any additional questions at this time?
I wish I would like you to comment, if you would, on the jurisprudence concerning the life without for a juvenile sentence, given the evolving jurisprudence by the U.S. Supreme Court in this area.
Well, Your Honor, in this particular case, he did receive life without parole. And it is of concern. That's why I raise the issue as cruel and unusual. The United States Supreme Court has enunciated in Adkins, for example, that it would be unconstitutional to sentence a juvenile to death. I would think that the same type of reasoning should be applied here. And I think also, Your Honor, as you may have noted in my briefs, I combine that particular argument with arguments that there was ineffective assistance of counsel for failure to call the expert and notice the expert. So my argument is that this is cruel and unusual. It is such a harsh penalty, and you combine it with the fact that the attorney did not even notice the only expert he had, which was Dr. Paglini. With that, if there are no further questions.
And that's something that should be addressed on post-conviction, though.
Your Honor, I know that there was argument on Monday in front of this court. It may have been a different panel. About whether it should be addressed on direct appeal. And I know that there is a lot of case law suggesting that ineffective assistance should not be heard on direct appeal. However, the cases I've cited show that when it's within the record and there's nothing more, then it can be heard. And what I would suggest to the court is that the trial counsel admitted, I didn't notice this man. I didn't notice Dr. Paglini. And so therefore, we could remand it and say, did you notice him? And the obvious answer is already in the record. I don't think we need sworn testimony because he's an officer of the court. He's already put it on the record. It was error. And either the court should not have precluded it under Floyd, or it is ineffective assistance of counsel under Strickland versus Washington.
Thank you.
We used up some of your time with our questions. We're down to 2:32. We'll give you 4 minutes on rebuttal.
Good morning, Justices. My name is Sonia Jimenez with the Clark County District Attorney's Office, and I'm representing the state of Nevada today. There were not multiple Crawford violations in this case because there were not testimonial statements that were admitted in violation of Crawford. The testimony of Detective Anderson was, did you have information that led you to investigate Thayer Burton as a suspect? And she responded that she did. What that information was not provided in testimony and was not provided in evidence. Furthermore, appellant's comment that, that essentially the state did this even after there had been a motion for mistrial misstates the record somewhat. There was a motion for mistrial after the opening statement, but the trial judge not only overruled it, but ruled that the state could get into that information and could discuss that information with the detective. And then prior to the detective's testimony, there was a conversation between defense counsel and the court outside the presence of the jury discussing what was the best way to ask this question. That was the question that the court specifically approved. That's exactly the way the state asked it, and it was absolutely appropriate. There are cases that support the fact that how the police came to investigate a particular individual is relevant and is important, and this was particularly the case here, where the defense had made it clear from the beginning that they were going to be challenging the investigation. Their defense was one of identity, and what often goes hand in hand with identity as well. The reason that this is the person who didn't do it is because the police didn't completely investigate and identify the person who did commit this crime. That was apparent from the beginning from voir dire, even prior to opening statements, and then it was followed throughout the testimony of the various state witnesses by cross-examination by the defense. And that's the type of situation where the cases have found it acceptable to talk about this type of information. There's a federal case in U.S. v. Obie where they said it was appropriate for a detective to testify about a fact that a known drug dealer had basically identified the defendant as somebody who was involved in that situation and that they had been able to then investigate the defendant based on that. And part of the reason that they found that way was because there was overwhelming evidence in that case. There was sufficient evidence that it wasn't as though the state was relying just on that information. And that's the same thing here. The legitimate reason for introducing that information was to explain to the jury how they got to the defendant, Thayer Burton. They didn't just pull him out of thin air, or they didn't focus on him without a reason to the exclusion of all others. They had a legitimate reason to investigate him. It wasn't argued in closing arguments that, hey, the reason you should convict Mr. Burton is because of this confidential informant who identified him as the murderer. It was based on the forensic evidence, his fingerprint on the victim's vehicle that had been washed the day before, the victim's DNA on his sweatshirt, the description of the individual who was waiting in the parking lot to basically ambush Mr. Bills, the witness who described the defendant as being similar to that person that she saw in the parking lot, and Andrew Thompson's testimony that the defendant had admitted those statements to him. So that was not a violation of Crawford, and it was appropriate in this case. Furthermore, as far as the testimony about the course of investigation in Lucia Ravelis, again, there were not statements that were admitted. These were not testimonial statements that Crawford prohibits. It was talked about what the detective did and the information that she did not receive from Lucia Ravelis. So it's not statements at all. It's the fact that Lucia Ravelis didn't come forward and provide her cell phone records as other witnesses had, as other employees of Ashley Furniture had. And it's also that, she didn't mention the fact that, hey, I know the guy that you arrested for having committed this crime over multiple interviews. It was the fact that she moved to another store. So these are not testimonial statements. And even, frankly, if you were to consider sort of her silence as some sort of statement, then they certainly weren't admitted for the truth of the matter because the evidence showed, not just the state's evidence, but the defense evidence, that, in fact, Lucia Ravelis did know Thayer Burton. So her silence wasn't being used to show that she didn't know the defendant, but that she was being untruthful or not forthcoming with information. So I think even if you did somehow view that as a testimonial statement, it wasn't admitted for the truth of the matter, and it's therefore outside hearsay and not testimonial. It wasn't to be used from her point of view in court.
Well, did the detective characterize her as an unindicted co-conspirator?
She did not use that language, Your Honor. And what the relevance and the significance of Lucia Ravelis' testimony is that the evidence showed in this case that this was something that was not only planned out ahead of time, but that the person who committed the crime had to have particular information in order to commit the crime. They had to know when Mr. Bills was going to leave the store to go make that bank deposit. They had to know the fact that he kept the money hidden on his person, because how would somebody just standing around know that Mr. Bills had that bank bag full of deposit money because it's hidden on his person? And they would have had to know what his vehicle looked like. He drove a very distinctive vehicle, an orange PT Cruiser, and they had to have that information because the evidence showed that the attack happened right there at that vehicle. And so in order to show that the defendant is the person who committed this crime, it was certainly relevant to show that he had a connection to somebody in the store who could provide that information to him, and that connection was Lucia Ravelis. So it was relevant testimony. It was important evidence for the state to put forward in putting together this case against Mr. Burton.
Well, the question I have here from page 916 of the record is, in fact, you learned that she was later identified as being the inside source, correct? Yes.
I think that was a statement in reference to, it was after the testimony had occurred, or it was near the time, I can't remember if it occurred before or after, but the testimony about Lucia Ravelis, and it was testimony going to the fact that the police had investigated Lucia Ravelis as the inside source, and that was who they had identified, who they believed to be the inside source, and how the investigation went from there. But it wasn't just that statement, that conclusory statement. The underlying information and why the detective came to that conclusion was also part of her testimony. So mm-hmm. I think if that statement had been taken maybe just in and of itself, there might be some argument that it was inappropriate. But it was taken in the context of this is why we came to that conclusion, this is how we came to that person, and the investigation that went forward. And certainly, again, the investigation about potential other suspects in the case, again, that was not testimonial in nature. She talked about what she did, her own personal knowledge and her own personal actions, to go forward with the investigation. And it was very important in this case because of the attacks that the defense was making on the investigation that happened in this case, and that's brought forward, and you can tell that that's what the defense was doing, not only by their comments in voir dire, by their questioning of the various witnesses, but then also their closing arguments. That was one of the themes of their closing arguments. And speaking of closing argument, I'd like to go on to the claims of Doyle error, and I think that what I would ask the justices to do and this court to do is to look at the entirety of the defense closing argument when you're considering this issue, because it wasn't just one statement made here or there by the defense. The defense had a theme to its argument, and it had, I would say, a threefold theme. Number one, they repeated this statement of how do you prove that you didn't do something? Number two was a full and fair investigation. The state didn't complete a full and fair investigation. Number three, although not explicitly said, was certainly implied in his argument, which was that the state was hiding evidence. The state doesn't want you to know the whole truth, but I, and he used himself personally, which in and of itself was objectionable. But he said, basically, I'm the one who put forward the evidence. I put forward Andrew Thompson. I put forward the defendant who corroborated and explained every piece of evidence provided by the state. And the state did nothing to rebut that. And he goes on for quite some time. His whole argument is about things that the state didn't do or that the investigation didn't show. And he even commented on things the state said in opening statement, that the state didn't mention the fact that Brandy Boutte said that the person outside Ashley Furniture appeared to be the defendant. Well, that was because the judge had prohibited us from mentioning that because she wanted to further consider the issue. So there was multiple improper arguments by the defense, and if we'd objected to every single one, we would have been on our feet constantly. We objected to the important ones, which included his statements that the state had not provided any evidence to rebut Mr. Burton. And we objected, which I think that invited error right there. We could have just gone on to argue it in rebuttal, but instead there was an objection by my co-counsel. We approached the bench, and there was a discussion that, hey, if the defense is going to argue this, that's going to open the door to us arguing that, well, we couldn't have rebutted that evidence because the first time we heard it was when the defendant took the stand. And trial defense counsel, Mr. Whipple, acknowledged that that was the case and acknowledged, sure, of course they can argue that. And he did not object during closing arguments to the statements of my co-counsel. And I think one other thing that's important to note is you also need to look at the rebuttal argument in its whole. The focus of the rebuttal argument, which I think is distinguishable from the Nevada cases, in addition, of course, to the invited error, is that the statement the co-counsel made was at the beginning of her argument. It was in direct rebuttal to the statements and the argument made of Mr. Whipple. And she did not go on to say, you know, look, he after a year and a half, we first heard this story, and you shouldn't believe him because of that, and he's not credible. That wasn't her argument. In fact, her argument about the credibility of the defendant's statement occurred at the end of her argument. It was very clear, if you look at the context of her whole argument, that statement, which occurred at the beginning, and the very next thing she said is, you know, what else are you going to do? You're going to attack the police investigation. Where clearly her directing to the main themes of the defense attorney, which was kind of the opening part of her rebuttal to challenge those themes. And then she went on to the specific facts. And she doesn't argue about the defendant's statement until the very end, in which she makes completely appropriate argument about why you wouldn't believe him, what his motivations would be, how his statement doesn't make sense, and how the other evidence contradicted that statement. And of course, what we have here that wasn't the case in Murray, or Murray, I'm not sure how you say it, but in that case, it was specifically a question of the credibility of the defendant versus the victim. And here, this was not a case of credibility between a defendant and a victim. There was overwhelming forensic evidence in this case. And there's just no way that the defense can get around that because the evidence here was so clear and so overwhelming between the forensic evidence, his fingerprint, his sweatshirt, his connection to the store, his statements to Andrew Thompson, his physical match of the description of the person waiting outside the Ashley Furniture store, that there was absolutely overwhelming evidence, and this does not arise to the level of plain error, which is the standard because there was no objection. I want to just
It does seem to be a close question about the commentary on the exercise of the defendant's Fifth Amendment privilege. Doesn't it?
As far as the statement made during argument?
Yes, ma'am.
Well, I think that's what I was trying to say with my argument about the timing of what took place. She makes that statement that's quoted by the defense, and then she doesn't continue to talk about the defendant's statement. She moves on to a different topic. So I don't think that it was what happened in Murray where he said, look, you shouldn't believe him because I'm sorry. But,
no, go ahead. I didn't want to interrupt your comment.
I think that's distinguishable from Murray because the statement wasn't, well, you know, he made up this statement. He wasn't credible. The victim gave a statement ahead of time. The victim, you know, interviewed with detectives several times. Those were the kind of comments that were being made in Murray, and they went on for some time. And so I think they are distinguishable. And I think that really the only reason the statement was made was because of defense counsel's argument, and that was made clear by our objection and our discussion at the bench. It wasn't something that we were trying to inappropriately comment on his right to remain silent, but at the same time, the defense and the defendant, although he's entitled to those rights, they can't use those to make an end run, to make inappropriate arguments, and then say, well, it's improper for the state to rebut those. Well, and that's what we did.
I appreciate the dilemma. The question I have, though, is generally the improper commentary on the exercise of Fifth Amendment right under a plain error analysis might be viewed as structural.
Well, and I think if this court, obviously I would say that it's not a violation of that comment, but if this court were to find that it was a violation, then I think the question the court has to answer was if it was prejudicial to the defendant. And I would argue that it was not prejudicial to the defendant because of the overwhelming evidence in the case. The end of the analysis.
And because of the invited error?
Exactly. And I think that's part of the analysis in the prejudice. I don't think you can just look at that in and of itself, but you have to look at what prompted the state to make that comment. The last thing, if I could, I'd like to comment on. Well, first, let me just briefly comment on the life without the possibility of parole. The U.S. Supreme Court cases, the most recent one, Graham v. Florida, specifically limits that decision to non-homicide offenses, and it's throughout the decision, that's the term that they use, non-homicide offenses. So I think they were very clearly distinguishing juvenile offenses that are not homicides to a murder case like we have here. And the state certainly presented ample evidence why life without the possibility of parole was appropriate, especially given the fact that after committing the murder, he continued to commit crimes, including robberies, including a home invasion. And along those lines, I think that the issue with Dr. Puglini is something that needs to be raised as an ineffective assistance claim, because I think when we look at the record, we're going to be able to show that this was a strategic decision by Mr. Whipple, that he had previously done that successfully and been able to present witnesses without noticing them to the state. And I think we're also going to be able to show that it was not prejudicial to the defendant because of the evidence that was present during the penalty phase. I would also urge the court that the kind of farce that took place when a week later trial defense counsel put Dr. Paglini on the stand was not an adequate representation of what would have occurred in the trial, because we still didn't have notice, we still didn't have discovery, and in fact, Dr. Paglini wouldn't even have testified. He was unavailable. Mr. Whipple wanted to put up Dr. Glavinsky, whose testimony would have been limited by the fact he didn't do the tests, and certainly would have been different from Dr. Paglini. So I think that that's something to be addressed on post-conviction, because I think there are evidentiary issues, and we certainly are going to be able to show that, A, it was not ineffective, it was a strategic decision, and B, that it certainly was not prejudicial, especially considering the overwhelming evidence in this case.
Well, I think the court's resorting to post-conviction on these direct appeal questions, you time and time again see there's more to the whole story by the time you go through post-conviction.
Right, and there's more evidence that can be presented in evidentiary hearings that are fact issues that this court doesn't have in the record that haven't been explored, because you don't stop in the middle of a trial and put the defense attorney on the stand and start questioning him about his trial strategy. And so I think in this case in particular, it's something that has to be addressed on post-conviction. I would submit that.
Does Grant afford reasoning for extending a prohibition against life without for a juvenile who commits murder?
No, I do not believe that there should be a prohibition against having life without for a juvenile who commits murder, and I think this case is the perfect example of why that shouldn't be the case. It wasn't an easy decision for the jury to come to, but I think based on the choices that the defendant made, which included being involved in a shooting that happened prior to the murder, then committing the murder, which was a particularly cold and heartless case. He didn't even get the money. He shot Mr. Bills in the back as he ran away. He didn't have to shoot him at all, especially given the disguise he was wearing. He could have gotten away. And I would submit to the court that was done out of anger for not getting the money. And then he's not caught for a while, so he knows that he's committed this murder, and yet he continues to commit crimes that are violent in nature. So I think this is the perfect example of why life without parole should be an available option once the jury has considered all of the evidence, as they did here, and ultimately came to that conclusion.
Justice Perger, anything?
No.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Orman?
I would argue that it is there was so much testimonial hearsay. To hear the state sort of summarize it and say, oh, it was just explaining the investigation. I think in their brief, when they say on page 9 of their answering brief, that in fact, Laura Anderson testified that she had received information that led her to investigate defendant. Thus, the statement was proved at trial and was not made in bad faith. Think about what the state is saying. The state is saying, we proved the tip. We proved all of that information, and there was no witnesses to support it with the exception of Detective Anderson. This wasn't a one-time statement of tip. It was the tip that led to Thayer Burton. It was the 15 or 20 suspects that they had received tips on. None of those witnesses testified. How can a detective be permitted to give sweeping conclusions regarding a case without a single witness to support that? Maybe there was truth to it. Call witnesses to support it. Furthermore, I do not, on a separate issue, understand how it was invited error for a prosecutor to tell a jury, maybe you come up with a story a year and a half after a murder and come up with a story that conveniently fits all the pieces of the puzzle or explains away every piece of incriminating evidence. Maybe that's what you do. That is Murray. That's exactly what this court cannot permit. It didn't permit it in Murray. And I can't see, when I hear the prosecutor argue, I don't understand what is the invited error.
But is that error structural? Or under plain error, is the analysis prejudicial?
I would argue,
in the absence of it being treated as structural, then counsel's argument makes some sense with respect to other evidence.
I did not see that it made any sense other than to just directly comment on the Fifth Amendment right. And I would argue, and I address plain error in my brief, I would argue that it affects his substantial rights. And it goes right to the heart of, you could do that in every single case. You could make that comment. Every time a defendant testifies, it doesn't matter what trial, let me be the prosecutor. Maybe you come up here with a story a year and a half, 6 months, 2 years, 3 years, however long it is, after a crime and come up with a story that conveniently fits all the pieces of the puzzle or explains away every piece of incriminating evidence. Maybe that's what you do. And you can do that every single time. And a prosecutor can do it every single time. At some point, there can't just be excuse after excuse that the district attorney's office would make about something like that. Don't make the comment. When I hear the state argue that there's overwhelming evidence, if there's overwhelming evidence, why'd you have to push the envelope?
Mr. Orem, in this particular case, though, didn't the defense counsel indicate that the state had failed to impeach Mr. Burton?
That they had no evidence that would contradict what he was saying. No, that does not invite a comment on the Fifth Amendment right. No. What it does is it permits the following. Ladies and gentlemen, there's overwhelming evidence. Here, look at all the things the prosecutor just said to this court. You just go through all of the evidence and tell the jury, look at all the evidence. Look at all the evidence. You cannot agree with Mr. Burton because look at all this overwhelming evidence. Don't comment on his Fifth Amendment right to testify. That's what they did. That's the problem here, as I see it. That if you want to rebut it, show what evidence you have. Don't just say, hey, this guy just made the story up because he's been listening to this and he's been waiting a year and a half to concoct this story. That's the difference. The other thing that I would, if I have enough time, I only have 10 seconds, but when they talk about Ms. Revelis and they say that she was the inside job, you know, the defense was precluded from putting on...
Finish the statement.
The defense was precluded from putting on the father of her children who had committed similar type robberies and would be an alternative suspect. I recognize that the court could say, wasn't that man on house arrest? Yes, but it was a theory of defense. And what happened in this case was multiple errors that should result in a new trial for Mr. Burton. With that, if there are no more questions, I...
Thank you. This matter will stand submitted. We thank counsel for their arguments this morning and shedding light on facts of interest and legal theories.